So I thought I'd talk tonight a little bit about Christopher Columbus. You guys, of course, all know that Monday is Columbus Day, right? That's on your radar. I wouldn't have realized it myself unless I were trying to take my car into the shop on Monday and somebody here had alerted me to the fact that the shop might not be open on Monday because it's Columbus Day. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Columbus Day, who might be from outside the country, it's a traditional holiday that we have here that commemorates Columbus's first landing in the New World in the Caribbean islands, which was said to have happened on October 12th. And by way of introduction, I'll just recap the story a little bit. This is based on what I learned in my fourth grade geography class, so it's a little basic, but I'll warn you in advance that it's also a metaphor. So in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. After many years of trying to organize this voyage, petitioning various courts, trying to raise funds, find investors to back his efforts, conditions finally came together and he was able to actually set out to sail the seas. So he sailed west from southern Spain, headed, of course, as we all know, to India. This was his final destination. That's where he was going. That's where he told everyone, his friends, his family, his investors. That's where he thought he was headed. The Ottoman Empire was expanding, and it had become increasingly difficult to get those wonderful Asian goods across land via the traditional trade routes. So he was going to find a sea route there. That's what he was setting out to do. So India was where he was bound. But the reason that it took him so long to actually organize this trip and to get the necessary backing is that pretty much everybody thought he was crazy. It wasn't so much that they thought that the world was actually flat. We realize now that most educated people realized that wasn't the case at that time. But they thought that he had just grossly miscalculated, that he was really being overly optimistic about how far away it was and how long it would take to get there and what would be required. They said that he would be lost at sea along with their investments and it would all come to naught. It would just be an exercise in futility. But what actually ended up happening was option C, none of the above. Instead, he ran into a huge landmass that nobody in Europe really knew was there at that time. It was something that Columbus, with all of his optimism, didn't foresee. It was something that his detractors, with all of their pessimism, didn't foresee. It was something that, in fact, was far more momentous than anybody had foreseen, something totally beyond the scope of what he had originally intended. So our holiday of Columbus Day, which is a somewhat dubious holiday these days, celebrates this big surprise, this gross miscalculation. And in a way, it's a good metaphor for the journey that we're undertaking here. So after major preparations of various kinds, possibly spanning years, a lot of convincing and conniving, you've managed to arrive here, finally, and start on this journey. Very likely there were people at home who have implied in more or less direct ways that you were on a bit of a fool's errand, that it was all going to come to naught, or worse. And very likely you've set forth with some kind of expectations about what you would find, where you would arrive, where you're headed, where you plan to set down anchor by the end of this journey. But the point of this talk, which I'm finally getting around to here, is that in fact we actually don't have any idea where we're headed, much like Columbus. That's the very nature of a journey of exploration in the external world, and it's the same in the internal world. By definition, when we head out to survey uncharted territory, we don't know what we're going to find. We don't know what we're going to encounter, no matter how carefully we've studied and planned. We may or may not arrive at whatever our own personal meditative equivalent of India is. We may arrive somewhere else altogether, and we certainly have no way of knowing what we'll encounter along the way. Nevertheless, expectations can be very difficult to let go of, and we can see this in the story of Christopher Columbus as well. After that first landing in the Caribbean islands on his first trip, he proceeded to spend the rest of his life trying to convince himself and everyone else that he had actually found Asia. He couldn't let go of that fixation he had on his initial goal. He couldn't move on. And it can be the same in our practice. We can become so fixated on our expectations that we actually miss what's really happening, which might be extraordinary. It might be even more momentous than what we had initially set our vision on. So our expectations can really become blinders that narrow our view of what we're actually doing and what we're actually learning through this journey. Ironically, our expectations can actually hamper our ability to actually realize what it is we're expecting, because we're not open to all of the options and opportunities that are actually available on the horizon. Early in my practice, when I was on a three-month retreat like this, sitting where you're sitting now, I heard this story about the danger of expectations, and it really stuck with me and has informed my practice over the years. And actually, I think some form of it has already been mentioned in one of the talks, but I'll mention it again because I like it. And it's got a good punchline. So a young man approached a great master and asked to become his student and learn his art. "How long," asked the prospective student, "will it take me to become a master like you?" 15 years, replied the master. "So long," exclaimed the young man in dismay. "Well, in your case," said the master, reconsidering, 20 years. The young man was alarmed, but he persisted. "What if I practice day and night in every waking hour, devoting all of my energy to learn this art?" 25 years, replied the master. The young man now became angry. "You're talking nonsense," he said. "How can it be that if I work harder, it will take longer to achieve my goal?" But the master said simply, "If you have one eye fixed on your destination, then you have only one eye left with which to find your way." So the point of the story is not that we shouldn't work hard, not that we shouldn't try to do our best, and not that we shouldn't have aspirations, some sense of what direction we're headed in our lives over the long run. In fact, it's very important to have some sense of direction in our spiritual life. But aspirations are very different from expectations. Aspirations acknowledge the open-ended nature of this journey that we're on, the unpredictability of it. They focus on the big picture and the long term without making demands that things unfold in a certain way as we progress. So, for example, the aspiration for freedom from suffering, one that we express here often, or liberation of the heart and mind, or to be a benefit to all beings. Those are aspirations that implicitly include a great deal of faith, that if we walk this path with sincerity, good things will come of it, that we can trust the Dhamma will reveal itself in just the perfect way that we need to see it in our own minds, bodies, and lives. Expectations, on the other hand, are really a manifestation of fear, of a lack of trust in the process, a lack of faith. They can be a way of trying to micromanage our unfolding, as if we needed to constantly monitor our progress to make sure that we're doing okay, as if we had to constantly keep an eye on ourselves and be constantly reassuring ourselves. So expectations can reflect a basic discomfort with the unpredictable nature of the spiritual journey. And that quality of doubt as Patricia talked about in her talk on the hindrances, can be a huge stumbling block to progress on the path, because it creates a climate in the mind that in and of itself is unconducive to the very opening that we're longing for. It's a great paradox in spiritual life. In the late 90s, I spent a year in Burma practicing as a Buddhist nun with Sayadaw Upandita, one of the Burmese meditation masters who's had a great influence on the practice that we do here. And I was in silent retreat for most of that time, but there was a day when I was moving from having spent some time at the city center to going out to the rural country retreat center, kind of similar to IMS here. And at that same time, there was another American woman who was also a nun, but she was going the opposite direction from me. She was coming back after having spent a year out in the country practicing in retreat. So as our paths crossed at the truck, after I had arrived out in the country and my luggage was being unloaded and her luggage was being unloaded, we had just a few minutes to talk, and she told me a little bit about what her year had been like there. And she said that the biggest obstacle that she had encountered had been her own expectations. She had done many long retreats like this one here in the West, and she felt she had made great progress in her path. She was very satisfied with her practice. And she said that she had come to Burma to practice with the feeling that it would kind of be like getting her diploma in meditation. It was kind of her doctoral thesis on the spiritual path. You know, she'd done all the right kind of preparation in the West and worked up to it little by little. And she figured she would come to Burma, spend a year practicing a good long period of time, and get enlightened, at least the first stage. And then she'd be set for life, more or less. She'd have the big breakthrough. But what happened when she actually got to Burma and started practicing was that she was in constant torment from her expectations, from her own pressures that she placed on herself. She was constantly evaluating how it was going, how she was doing, what milestones she might have reached, conjecturing about how her practice was progressing, what her teachers would have thought about her, and assessing whether or not she was going to achieve her goal in that year that she had to work there. And she said that she went on like this for months, basically just worrying about how her practice was going, rather than fully devoting herself to the practice itself. At some point, many months into her retreat, she finally gave up. She decided that there was no way she was going to reach her goal in the time she had, that it was all futile, and she was just going to have to do her best to get through the remaining months that she had in retreat, just kind of make it through. And that turned out to be a major turning point in her practice. She said she started practicing then without expectations, just kind of taking things one day at a time, one breath at a time, without really looking forward, without anticipating, and it completely changed her experience. She began to actually have the kinds of openings that she was longing for. She said that it was only when she had stopped fixating on enlightenment that she could actually get down to business and do the things that would help eventually lead her toward enlightenment. And she said that she was prepared to spend the rest of her life on that path, regardless of whether or not she ever realized anything that she might call enlightenment. So in a way, her expectations had become aspirations, and her practice was much more satisfying and rewarding. I've recently been working on a project to translate one of the main modern classics of Burmese meditation literature into English. It's a book called How to Practice Vipassana. Very straightforward. And it's a very comprehensive guide to both the theory and the practice of the same basic style of meditation that we're teaching here, that we're practicing here. It's a book that was written right in the thick of World War II by the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw. And Mahasi Sayadaw was one of the founding fathers, really, of modern Vipassana practice. In a way, he has a lot to do with all of us being here right now. He was a great benefactor who lived in Burma during the last century. He taught Joseph's teacher, Munindraji, who in turn taught Joseph, and here we are, all of us today, here 30 years later. So I found a story in that book as I was going through it that's originally from the commentaries on the Pali Canon, and it deals with the subject of expectations and how they can interfere with our progress. It's the story of a monk called Venerable Mahasiva, who was apparently a very prominent Buddhist teacher in ancient India sometime after the Buddha's time. He was said to have taught the Buddhist scriptures to 18 different sects, different schools of Buddhism, and that thousands of monks had become enlightened under his guidance. So one day, one of these enlightened students of his was kind of sitting around in meditation, enjoying his enlightenment, and reflecting on the numerous virtues and benefits that it had brought him, how wonderful it was to be enlightened, basically. And it occurred to him that as great as the benefits that he had experienced were, his teacher's power of mind and virtues and benefits must be even greater. They must be really stunning. So using his supernormal powers, as enlightened beings were wont to do in those days, he investigated his teacher's mind. But he was a little bit surprised at what he found, that not only were Mahasiva's attainments not as great as his own, but Mahasiva wasn't enlightened even a little bit, not at all. He was just still an ordinary, unenlightened person, what in the scriptures is called an ordinary worldling. So the monk thought to himself, you know, this is no good, that this great teacher of mine isn't enlightened yet. How can that be? So again, using his supernormal powers, he flew off to Mahasiva's monastery, something that also used to happen a lot, apparently. And his objective was to remind his teacher of what his duty to himself was in his own practice. So he sat down a little ways away from the monastery. He didn't want to cause too much commotion. And he approached Mahasiva and asked for an interview with him. But the teacher said that he was too busy right at that moment. So the monk said, well, what about while you're waiting at the gate of the monastery before you go out for alms round? And the teacher said again, no, he would be busy then also with some other monks that were studying with him. So the monk said, well, how about while you're walking to the village on alms round? And again, Mahasiva was going to be busy at that time. How about while you're having lunch? He was going to be busy. How about while he was walking back from the village? He was going to be busy. How about after he got back to the monastery and was resting? Busy. During the afternoon rest period? Busy. When he was getting ready for bed? Busy. Whatever time the monk proposed to meet with Mahasiva, he was always going to be busy with his various duties. So the monk said to him, the way you're living, you don't even have time to die. You should really take time to practice your own meditation while you can. You've been living like a chair, supporting other people but not yourself. And with this, the monk flew back off into the sky, at which point Mahasiva realized that the monk hadn't actually come to learn from him, but to teach him. And he felt really embarrassed that the student of his had clearly attained great heights of realization while he was still just an ordinary worldling. So he resolved to do something about it and reach a similar, if not greater, attainment. So early the next morning, Mahasiva left his monastery to spend some time in retreat. But he only took a few really necessary items with him, and he didn't tell anybody where he's going, because he figured, it ought to be pretty easy for somebody like me to get enlightened. You know, I've been teaching all these students, I know the scriptures really well. In 2 or 3 days ought to do it. I'll be back before they even miss me, and then I'll show them who I am. And it just happened then to be 2 days before the full moon. And Mahasiva thought to himself, oh, this is perfect. I'll practice for 2 days, and then I'll get enlightened on the full moon day, just like the Buddha. That'll be really impressive. So Mahasiva found a nice secluded spot near a village where he could go for alms in a little valley, and he settled down to practice. And the full moon day came around, and the full moon day passed, and Mahasiva was somewhat surprised to find that he wasn't enlightened yet. It hadn't happened. But he wasn't too put out. He thought, well, I must need just a little bit more time. 2 days really isn't very much. The rainy season is just getting started, so I'll do a 3-month retreat, as the Buddha recommends, and then I'll be able to return triumphant at the end of my 3-month retreat. So Mahasiva kept practicing, and the 3 months passed, and much to his surprise, he still wasn't enlightened. So now Mahasiva really started to become alarmed, because it was well known that many monks and nuns became enlightened during the 3-month rains retreat, and yet he hadn't managed it himself. So he really started to feel inadequate, and the high opinion that he had had of himself started to crumble. And he sat down and wept bitterly with disappointment and despair. So from then on, it's said, Mahasiva kept his bed folded. He spent all of his time practicing intensively, and he didn't even lie down to rest, fearing that he might lose precious time to practice. And in this way, he passed 30 years in retreat. At the end of every rainy season, when he found that another year had passed and he still hadn't attained enlightenment, he would sit down and cry with discouragement and self-pity. At the end of the 30th year, as he was sitting and crying in this way, as was his wont, he happened to notice the sound of someone else crying nearby, which caught him somewhat by surprise, because this little valley where he'd been practicing was very secluded. He hardly ever encountered anyone else there. So he called out, "Who's there? Who's crying?" And the response came back, "I am a deva, sir, a celestial being that was passing through the valley." "What are you doing crying here?" asked Mahasiva. "Well," said the deva, "I was just passing by, and I noticed how you were practicing. And based on your example, I figured I could attain 2 or 3 stages of enlightenment at least just by sitting down here and crying. So I thought I'd give it a try." And with that, the deva let out a little laugh and disappeared. So this really caught Mahasiva by surprise. And he thought to himself, has it come to this, that even the passing devas are mocking me? But then he reflected on what the deva had said, and he realized that this deva actually did have a point. That as hard as he had been practicing for so many years, all the time it had been with an attitude of dejection and self-pity. It was as if he could see his own heart and mind for the first time. So Mahasiva calmed his mind. He set aside his discouragement, and little by little he began to develop mindfulness, concentration, and insight. And in this way, Mahasiva eventually became one of the arahants. So this story makes some very important points about our relationship to our expectations and practice. The most obvious one is just what a sand trap our expectations can become. We can get so caught up in them that we end up in a holding pattern, circling round and round our ideas about what ought to be happening, so that we're never able to actually get anywhere. And as with Mahasiva, we can be working very hard, we can be making a great effort in practice, but just not getting anywhere because we only have that one eye with which to find our way. Another point that this story makes is the futility of disappointment, discouragement, and self-pity in this practice. There's actually a special place reserved in the Buddhist psychology for this type of suffering that's associated with spiritual ambition. And as Rebecca spoke about last night, there's quite a sophisticated and comprehensive map of the various types of suffering that are available to us as human beings in the Buddhist teachings, because it is such an important and central part of this path. It's a territory that's been very well explored and mapped over the centuries and the millennia. So this kind of disappointment or discouragement that comes from not getting what we want in practice is called niramisa dukkha, or that can be translated roughly as distress not associated with sense desire. So kind of our run-of-the-mill dukkha has to do generally with having unpleasant experiences in the sense sphere that we don't like, seeing or hearing, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking, something that we don't like, that we don't enjoy. But this kind of dukkha is a little bit different. It's not associated with any of those things. It's not something that's going to be satisfied or alleviated by having a nice cup of tea or a good nap. It really reaches beyond that to the realm of our spiritual endeavors and aspirations. And it's an important enough and prevalent enough kind of suffering now, as it was 2,500 years ago, that the Buddha thought that it deserved its own special category, its own name. And the Buddha also said that this type of suffering should be overcome by, guess what? Mindfulness. By simply bringing attention to the disappointment or discouragement itself. Mahasi Sayadaw talks about this a little bit in his book also, and he gives these very simple instructions for how to deal with this mental state of this kind of dukkha when it arises. He just says, when experiencing distress not associated with sense desires, know that distress not associated with sense desires is being experienced. Can't get any simpler than that. So all we need to do is just to not buy into the stories of discouragement that arise in our minds, but instead to bring them right into our practice, just as any other experience, something to be known and understood. So Mahasi Sayadaw doesn't say that this kind of distress needs to be forcibly eradicated, or that we shouldn't feel it in the first place. It will arise when conditions come together to produce it, just like any other experience. I think it's the rare yogi, if any, who never experiences periods of doubt, disappointment, or discouragement in their practice. It's part of the process. But the trick is to remember to just be mindful of these difficult mental states and regard them as we would any other passing thought or feeling. It's easy on a long retreat like this to fall into the fallacy that our thoughts and feelings about practice somehow deserve some kind of special exception from mindfulness. We tend to get pretty quickly when we hear that thinking about the past, thinking about the future, conjecturing, speculating, theoretical thinking, all these various types of extraneous thinking are unproductive and something that we can let go. But we may allow our thoughts and feelings about our practice, about what's actually going on here and now, kind of a general amnesty. They're somehow exempt, thinking that somehow they're different from other thoughts. They're more important. They're more relevant. They're more useful. But in fact, our thoughts and feelings about how our practice is going really need to be treated with exactly the same quality of mindfulness and investigation as any other experience that arises. Because ultimately, they are exactly the same as any other experience that arises. There's really nothing special about them unless we give them extra special status. So if we lose sight of the fact that thoughts about our practice here are really just the same as any other thoughts, then they can really become a hindrance. They can actually keep us from finding the satisfaction in our practice that we are craving. Another point that's implicit in this story is the importance of finding a good teacher who can point out to us where we're stuck in our practice. So because Mahasiva was so learned and so accustomed to being in the teaching role himself, he just assumed he'd be able to navigate his way through the uncharted territory of his own practice on his own. He assumed he'd be able to handle it all himself. But in fact, once he got going, once he got into his practice, he simply didn't have the perspective on his own process to see how he was caught up in his expectations. If he'd been working with a competent teacher, on the other hand, he would have had this pointed out to him pretty quickly. It's unlikely that 30 years would have gone by before he realized this. Instead, he had to wait for the snide deva to kind of come along and snap him out of his trance. And this is really true for all of us. No matter how long we've been practicing, no matter how much ground we may have covered, how much territory we may have mapped of our internal landscape, we never really know what's waiting for us around the next bend. Each retreat is a new adventure. If we could predict what was coming down the line, then we wouldn't be exploring anymore. We wouldn't be expanding our horizons anymore. So it's really helpful to have a teacher who has at least a somewhat bigger picture of the lay of the land, who can help us to navigate as we go along and avoid possible pitfalls. So there's another story from Mahasi's book that deals with this topic of the importance of finding a good teacher. So just as we can have expectations for ourselves in practice of how we ought to be doing and what we ought to be accomplishing, we can also have expectations regarding our teachers on the path, of who they ought to be and how they ought to behave and how they ought to relate to us. And this can also become a hindrance if we let it get in the way of getting the guidance that we need. So in the time of the Buddha, there was a monk named Potila. And he was apparently one of these people that today we would say had a photographic memory. It was said that he had memorized the complete teachings of 6 past Buddhas during various of his lifetimes. So it was kind of a habit with him to do this. And during the time of our historical Buddha, he did the same thing. He memorized all of the teachings, all of the sutras. And because of this great store of academic knowledge that he had, his tremendous ability to recall, he was sought out as a teacher by many yogis. And he felt very satisfied with his knowledge. He was very happy with the power and the clarity of his intellectual faculties. So he didn't really bother to meditate. But one thing really irked him, and that was that whenever he met with the Buddha, the Buddha would address him as foolish Potila. And he just couldn't understand this. It made no sense to him. He thought, I know the entire teachings of the Buddha by heart. I've taught scores of students. Why is the Buddha calling me foolish Potila? It doesn't make any sense. But after this had gone on for a while, and he'd reflected on it quite a bit, it occurred to him that, you know, it must be because I haven't meditated. So I don't have any practical knowledge to go with my intellectual knowledge. So he decided to take care of that and fix that problem. He thought, I'll go off and do a period of retreat and get enlightened, and then there won't be any more of this foolish Potila business. So he asked around about good places to practice, and heard about one place that sounded just really great. It was some distance away in a secluded little forest hermitage, but it was said to be inhabited by 30 arahants who were all excellent meditation teachers, and that it was a really great place to get enlightened quickly. So Venerable Potila thought to himself, that sounds like the place for me. So he arranged his affairs and gathered up his things and set off for the secluded monastery. And eventually he found the place after wandering around a bit, and it was really pretty rustic. It wasn't even really a monastery, but just a spot out in the forest where this group of arahants had set up camp to live and practice together. And they lived very simply, just sleeping and sitting at the roots of the trees. They didn't even have any permanent dwellings. And they made do with very little, living very modestly. So Venerable Potila was a bit daunted when he saw what the conditions were at this place. But as he walked into the camp, he could feel that there was something really special about it too. There was a quality of stillness and tranquility in the air that he'd never encountered anywhere else before. And the arahants were all moving about mindfully, taking care of their business, with an appearance of serenity and joy that really moved him. And he thought to himself, these guys know something that I don't know. And he began to feel for the first time a real aspiration to purify his heart and mind rather than just to prove himself to the Buddha. So he approached the eldest monk and asked for meditation instructions. And the senior arahant kind of sized him up and sensed that even though Venerable Potila had some sincerity of aspiration, he was still pretty impressed with his own knowledge. He was still pretty full of himself. So the monk told him that he really didn't have time to take on any more students right at the moment, and sent him to talk to the second most senior monk. He said, check with him, maybe he'll take you on. So the second most senior monk spoke with Upatila a bit and came to basically the same conclusion that the first monk had come to. And he sent him to the third most senior monk, who sent him to the fourth most senior monk, who sent him to the fifth most senior monk, and so on down the line. And as he descended through the ranks of seniority, asking for guidance first from monks who were his seniors, then from monks who were his peers, then from monks who were his juniors, he started to get the message that these arahants really couldn't care less that he had memorized the entire teachings of the Buddha. That really didn't signify with them. And he became increasingly determined and interested to learn what it was that they knew that he didn't. So eventually, Venerable Potila found himself asking for meditation instructions from the youngest arahant of the group, who just happened to be a 7-year-old novice. The Buddha used to say that he taught the Dhamma in such a way that a 7-year-old child could understand it. And as if to prove it, we find in the sutta's many stories of 7-year-old arahants running around. So Venerable Potila found himself asking for instructions from this young monk, which just a short time before would have seemed preposterous to him, something he never would have imagined he would do. But by this time, Venerable Potila really had no pride left. He'd been broken. He was really just desperate for somebody at this monastery to give him meditation instructions so he could do his practice. So he paid respects to the little arahant as humbly as he could and asked for his guidance. And the novice could see that Venerable Potila was in earnest, but he wasn't sure he'd really be able to trust him. He wasn't sure that when push came to shove, this venerable elder monk would really pay attention to his instructions and follow them. So he demurred a bit, and he said, "Oh, venerable sir, I'm still very young and not very knowledgeable. I'm the one who should learn from you." But Venerable Potila was having none of it. He persisted in his request. So eventually the little novice said, "Well, if you'll follow my instructions meticulously, then I'll teach you how to practice meditation." And Venerable Potila exclaimed in a bit of a fervor, "Even if you ask me to walk through fire, I'll do exactly as you say." "Really?" said the novice, who was, after all, only 7 years old. "Well, then, go walk into the pond over there," he said, pointing to the pond in the forest there that the monks drew their water from. And without a moment's hesitation, Venerable Potila immediately walked off and started wading into the pond. However, just as the edge of his robe skimmed the water, the little novice called him back and said, "Okay, I'll teach you the meditation practice." So Venerable Potila began to practice with the guidance of the little arahant. And it's said that because he was so sincere and trusted his teacher so completely, he made very quick progress in his practice, and he avoided many possible pitfalls. And in time, with practice, Venerable Potila, too, became one of the arahants. So this story really points out the importance of recognizing that the important teachers in our lives and on our spiritual journey don't always take the forms that we expect them to. They may be someone who's not the most senior monk at the monastery. They may be that fellow yogi who just keeps doing that one really annoying thing, or that one thing that's just so clearly inappropriate. They may be that pain in our body that just won't go away no matter what we do, how we try to work with it, how much we adjust our posture, how many heating pads we apply. They may be that obsessive thought pattern that's just really interfering with our concentration and keeping us from being able to practice effectively. So important teachers come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, most of which we probably don't expect. But if we're attached to certain ideas about what and who we're willing to learn from and what and who we're not willing to learn from, we may miss out on all sorts of opportunities to grow and awaken. If Venerable Patila had decided that he just wasn't willing to accept a 7-year-old meditation teacher, he may have wandered off into the woods to practice on his own and spent 30 years spinning his wheels, like Mahasiva. We can come to this practice with a lot of expectations about what kinds of conditions we need to be able to practice effectively. And those expectations themselves can keep us from practicing effectively. Which is not to say that we shouldn't give careful consideration to where we practice and when, under whose guidance we should. But just as Rebecca said last night, there's no perfect kuti. If we keep waiting for all of the conditions to come together in just the way we think they should, we'll be waiting forever, because there's no such thing as perfect conditions. So again, our expectations about how our teachers or our practice environment ought to be are just another aspect of experience to be mindful of, just more passing impersonal thoughts to notice as what they are, just thoughts. So a long retreat like this is really an epic adventure, on par with anything that we can find in history or mythology. It's a journey into the unknown, and we're bound to learn from it. There's no way really that we can keep from learning from it. We just have no idea beforehand what we're going to learn from it or how. But that's really part of the joy of this process, the joy of discovery. The joy of seeing how our own unique path unfolds moment by moment, day by day. Even in our darkest moments, it's taking just exactly the path that it needs to for us to unfold. So enjoy the adventure and happy sailing. If you have one eye fixed on your destination, then you have only one eye left with which to find your way.